WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With Glasnost and Perestroika, American journalists have been given unprecedented opportunities to observe and record Soviet life. Hedrick Smith has taken advantage of this new openness to return to the Soviet Union with a camera crew to document the new freedoms and the new crises under Gorbachev. Smith hosts the four-part PBS series Inside Gorbachev's USSR. Hedrick Smith was used to the days when journalists assumed the KGB was on their tail. He was the Moscow bureau chief for the New York Times in the early 70s and won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting. His 1976 bestseller, The Russians, was about life in the Soviet Union. I recorded an interview with him a couple of days ago. Smith told me he started reporting for the Times shortly before Khrushchev died. After Khrushchev's death, Smith went on the street hoping to sample popular opinion, as he would for a story in the United States. But the Russians in the street wouldn't be caught talking to the press. During Smith's recent trip to the Soviet Union, Smith and the executive director of the PBS series, Martin Smith, found a dramatic change.
We were just beginning to prepare, do our negotiations, and kind of try out our own relationship and see what we could do. And Marty said to me at one point, he had a mini camera he was taking with me. He said, let's go out on the street and do some man-in-the-street interviews. Well, my mind went right back to that experience with Khrushchev's death, and I said, well, we'll give it a try, but I'm not sure what's going to happen. I had talked to many Russians in the 70s, but usually privately, personally, developed relationships and that sort of thing. We went out on a bridge across the Moscow River, right near the Kremlin, along the route that Reagan was going to take for his summit talks with Gorbachev. And I said, Marty, put the camera down till I get things started. I hadn't spoken the Russian, so I wanted to try out my Russian. Well, he kept the camera up, and instead of alienating people and shooing them away, the camera attracted them, much the same way as it does in New York or Philadelphia or Los Angeles or some city in this country. And the people gathered around, and we started talking, and they said nice things about Reagan, and they hoped he would have good summit talks with Gorbachev. We would have peace between our two countries and so forth. And that was the change. That was the single biggest change for me from the 70s to the 80s. Was the willingness of people to speak out publicly and their dramatic loss of fear of the police state from the early 70s. I can't say the fear is all gone and that everybody was totally candid. That doesn't even happen in this country. But the change was enormous, and obviously it was absolutely vital to the kind of project we were engaged in, which was trying to find the human side of Perestroika and how it was really affecting people, you know, down at the grassroots.
Did you have any reservations about putting people on camera in case Perestroika and Glasnost fall apart and are followed by a crackdown?
In all honesty, I didn't, and I'll tell you why. Back in the 70s, I developed the practice of very early identifying myself to people as a New York Times correspondent. And in some cases, people moved away from me. If I met them in a crowd or at a railroad station or on a train or on an airplane or just had an accidental encounter with them, we'd talk a little bit. And before we got very far into it, I would identify myself as a correspondent so that they were free to exit the situation, to get out of it, to protect themselves. My assumption always was that Soviets know their system better than we do. They know what risks they can take and they're willing to take and what risks they ought not to take.
What's happened to the KGB? I'm sure when you were there in the 70s, there was this constant fear that you were under surveillance and that the people you were talking to might be under surveillance. Is there any fear like that now? Did you ever feel like there was the possibility of being trailed by the KGB? What are they up to now?
Well, let me tell you, it was not an abstract fear in the 70s. I mean, we could hear our phone being tapped. We could watch ourselves being tailed both by car and on foot, sometimes when we were just going over to the grocery store. I mean, it was a very, very real thing, and there were people who told us about incidents that happened to them after we contacted them. So it was very real presence. That, again, is a dramatic and striking difference. Now, that doesn't mean the KGB has gone out of business. What it means is that they've got other things they're worrying about more. They're worried about real spies rather than tailing just general foreigners and journalists as much as they were before. Their manpower is spread thin, but they're still operating. They're worried about labor unrest. They're worried about espionage. They're worried about the border controls. They're worried about bigger national security issues, and of course they're continuing with their espionage.
When you were in the Soviet Union, did you see many former hardliners still in governmental positions who had maybe changed their attitude a little bit and you didn't know whether to trust them or not?
Sure. One of the games going on in the Soviet Union today is playing along with perestroika on the surface and sabotaging it underneath. Gorbachev talks about it all the time, about these armies of bureaucrats and party hacks who are sabotaging and undermining, delaying, blockading his program. And of course, when we're going around talking to people who are in positions of power around the country, particularly out in the provinces, we run into them all the time. We talk to the Moscow party boss, Yuri Prokofiev. He made all kinds of nice sounds about how he was trying to help democratize the city. And then when the city actually got a democratic government of non-communist representatives elected in March, what did the Moscow Communist Party do? It appropriated all the city buildings for the city government, saying that they had been built by the party and that they really shouldn't be taken over by the local government. So he was obviously giving democracy a very hard time. There is a real struggle going on in the Soviet Union today at every level of that society, in every walk of life, about whether or not reform is going to move forward or is going to be thrown back. It's going on all the time.
So there must be the sense of not knowing who you can really trust.
Well, Russians basically operate on the principle that they can't trust many people. They operate fundamentally in their public life on the basis of mistrust. But part of what's happened, in all honesty, is that the openness that has been brought by Glasnost has gotten more and more people on the record one way or another. There is an enormous mistrust on the part of the ordinary rank-and-file people for the bureaucracy, for the party hierarchy. And there could even be some good people in the party hierarchy in various different provincial areas, and the public would mistrust them.
My guest is journalist Hedrick Smith, and he's the host of the public television series Inside Gorbachev's USSR. The last program in your series is on nationalism and nationalist unrest in the Soviet Union. Let's look a little bit at the three Baltic republics, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, which have each been campaigning for independence. What have been some of the greatest problems for people in these three republics under Soviet domination?
Well, the suppression of their culture and their national identity. I mean, I didn't find many people in the 1970s who were willing to talk to me about it, but I went to all three republics and I found a few, but it was very risky for them. And sometimes you found people who were simply trying to keep alive Estonian folk art or the Catholic Church in Lithuania. By the way, the archbishop was banned and exiled even within Lithuania and couldn't practice any public services. Or other things in Latvia. I mean, they're just basic national sources of identity and independence, and they felt very Russified. Latvia, today is barely more than 50% Latvian in population, and the reason is that one of Stalin's policies was to move industry into the Baltic republics, and with it to move Russian workers, or workers from Russia mainly, but also the Ukraine and Belarus, from the Slavic republics, and gradually change the demographics within the Baltic republics. And if you notice, there is a difference in the ardency, the vigor with which they pursue independence. Lithuania is the most vigorous, and the reason, in my opinion, is that it's 80% Lithuanian, and Estonia is 60% Estonian, and Latvia is 53% Latvian. So they have to take into account this large minority population that's been moved in.
So what would the Soviets lose if these three Baltic countries were successful in seceding?
I think the most important thing Moscow would lose would be its pride. I think that the notion that a great power would see part of its empire fall apart and fall away from it is a great blow to the Russians as a people, the great Russians, ethnic Russians. Secondly, I think they are very concerned about the military approach to to European Russia, particularly with the collapse of the Warsaw Pact. They do have considerable number of troops and installations in the Baltic republics and in a little chunk of Russia around Kaliningrad, which is actually to the west of Russia. So they're concerned about that. I think they're concerned about the danger of the example to other republics. I think they could withstand it. I, frankly, have been a little surprised that Gorbachev, who has publicly recognized that the Baltic republics were forcibly attached to the Soviet Union by Stalin as a result of the Stalin-Hitler Pact back before World War II, that Gorbachev, having recognized this, didn't just say, okay, these three republics are different from the rest of the Soviet Union. They must go through negotiations with us and so forth, but they can actually get independence. He's been pretty tough towards them, and he's clearly trying to hold them in the Union. I think one other thing they'd lose is they feel that they'd lose the most advanced economically, the most advanced part of the Soviet Union. They don't want to do that.
There are a lot of Russians that resent the nationalist and independence movements. Why?
Well, part of this is ethnic pride. Part of this is a feeling that others have gotten advantages from Mother Russia. We have to know something about the geography of Russia and the history of Russia today. The Russian Republic is two-thirds of the land area and half of the population of the Soviet Union, roughly 150 million people, mostly ethnic Russians. Now, their claim is that economically they have sacrificed for the rest of the Union. And I think it's probably true if you look at Central Asia or the Caucasus, the republics way to the south and towards Asia. These are underdeveloped areas, and a lot of industry, a health system, an educational system, science, lots of elements of the modern world were built during the 20th century in these republics, and a lot of the money for that came from Russia. And what the Russians are saying is, hey, wait a minute, we sacrificed in years past and decades past, and these people now want to take the benefits of our investment and leave. That's really not quite so fair with the Baltics, but in any case, that's part of the general Russian feeling. The second thing is there are a lot of ethnic Russians who say that Russia has suffered under the Soviet system, that Russian churches were closed, that Russian culture was suppressed, that the Russian countryside was raped just as much as the countryside and the culture of the Baltic republics or of the Caucasian republics. And they have their rights too. And right now they're supplying oil and natural gas and this sort of stuff to the Baltic republics. Why should the Baltic republics, why should the little peoples, the Russians call these other republics the little peoples, why should the little peoples get away with being independent and walking away from the ship when it's sinking? Why shouldn't they have to stick around and fight it out and stick it through with all the rest of us?
How much is the Russian nationalist movement tied to the right wing?
Well, the right wing is part of the Russian nationalist movement, and it's the most vocal, most dangerous, most virulent part, and it's also the part that gets the most attention in the Western press. And that's only natural, but the difficulty is it's a distortion. There are lots of people who are Russian nationalists, that is, people who believe in and want to emphasize Russian culture, music, literature, poetry. Andrei Voznesensky, the poet, and I had a conversation last trip I was in Moscow, and we were sitting on a park bench talking, and, you know, he said, Chagall, Kandinsky, these great artists of the 20th century, they're all part of Russian culture, as much as Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and Chekhov and Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff and so forth. I want to emphasize these things, and I want to emphasize the glory of the Russian countryside, not just antagonism towards other nationalities. That's the positive side of Russian nationalism. The negative side of Russian nationalism is anti-Semitic, is anti-Lithuanian, is anti the little people. And the right wing is the most virulent part of it. And Pamyat society, which means memory, is a small but vocal and dangerous element. It's significant, though, to put these people in context. They ran, this extreme right wing, ran its candidates in recent elections this past March. And in Moscow, there were 460 seats up for the Moscow City Council, and the right wing won 10 seats. So they do exist. but they're not a very large portion of the public. And I think their danger is real, but it's been exaggerated by press reports in this country.
I've spoken to several people who've said that glasnost and perestroika in enabling free speech has also freed people up to speak of their hatreds. And it's made anti-ethnic sentiments, anti-Semitism, more virulent than it's been in recent years because people can express it. Do you share that view?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, the lid was on before, and it was very hard for people to say what they thought about anything, good or bad. There certainly was anti-Semitism, and there were, you know, real tensions among the nationalities before Gorbachev came into power. But what he did is he took the lid off, and now you can see it. Before you knew it, you bumped into it here and there, but it wasn't anywhere nearly as widely expressed. Now it's right out in the open, and sometimes it's very nasty.
I wonder if you think that the Soviet Union, which is so ethnically and nationalistically diverse, could be ruled in any way besides totalitarianism and keep everybody together.
Well, I don't think that if they are truly democratic that they will keep everybody together. But why should that be the touchstone? I mean, I think that if Gorbachev really allows political freedom and democracy, that the Baltic republics will be gone. But I do think that if you look at the vast population in the largest areas there, as I said before, 150 million Russians, 40 to 50 million Ukrainians, 50 million people living in Central Asia, that's 250 million people. I would guess that that body will stay together even if given their choice to separate, at least for another couple of decades and maybe well beyond that. If, and this is very important, there is economic progress, and if there is real democracy. One of the dangers that that Gorbachev is running now by taking a tough line towards the Baltics is that all the other nationalities are watching and they're drawing a lesson. There's a short-run lesson and a long-run lesson. The short-run lesson is don't challenge Moscow when it's strong and unless you're ready. The long-run lesson is the Russians in the end will suppress the minorities no matter what they say publicly. So get yourself ready for ultimate independence. In other words, if the Kremlin takes too hard a line towards the minority nationalities, their ultimate conclusion will be our only hope is secession, even if that's not what they want to do now. He's building the secessionist movements every week that he takes a hard line with the Baltic republics. Because I've talked to plenty of Ukrainians, and very few of them are interested in secession. But if he goes on like this, more and more of them will feel that way. And I think that economic progress, if he can find it, or the Soviet leadership can find it, and greater democracy can hold the bulk of that country together because of achievement, not because of totalitarian repression.
Have you ever met Gorbachev?
Yes.
Is there anything you got from him, any sense of him that you got from him in person that wasn't communicated through hearing about him or seeing him on TV? Any insights you got from actually meeting him?
Well, I think that that any time you meet a leader like that, you get a personal impression of him that, even if you've heard it before, is very different in the flesh. And that is the dynamism, the energy that radiates from this man. And I guess I will never forget the eyes. He has very penetrating, dazzling eyes. They look right through you and at you at the same time. They just convey energy and determinism. I mean, the man radiates an extraordinary magnetism. And even in a brief conversation, you get a sense of this man's absolute self-confidence and his conviction that he can move things forward. And that's terribly important. You sit here in America and you look at Gorbachev and you say, my God, look at the economy's in the mess. Lithuania and the Baltic republics want to quit. There's violence in the Caucasus, the right wing, the army, the KGB, the right wing of the Communist Party. They're all unhappy. Gorbachev has got to fall. I mean, how many times have we heard the prediction that Gorbachev's going to fall? I mean, there are some people who have been predicting it now for 3 years. Maybe eventually they'll be right. But when you meet the man, one of the things you get is the sense of why he hasn't fallen. And that is the chemistry of him as a person. We keep forgetting that politics has got a lot of personal chemistry to it. And I'm not just talking about the chemistry of a man coming across on the mass media. I'm talking about this man sitting in a little room in the Kremlin with the other members of the Politburo, or talking man-to-man with the head of the defense ministry or the head of the army or the head of the KGB. And the chemistry of his personality affects their attitude and their loyalty towards him. They know he's the boss. He is a man who simply communicates leadership. Now, that's something that you can appreciate physically in his presence in a way that's very difficult to get simply by reading it or even sometimes seeing him move around on television.
What issues will you be addressing in your new book, the one that you're writing now?
Well, I think the fundamental message that I have is this, that there is a process underway in that society which is going to take 20, 30, 40 years to play out. But the change has now got a dynamism and a momentum of its own that will carry on whether or not Gorbachev survives. My thesis is that we spend too much time looking at the headlines and the latest developments of this week or last week without grasping what's going on inside this society. And I think what is happening here is as dramatic and as sweeping and as important as Gandhi leading India to independence at the end of World War II, as Bismarck forming Germany back in the 19th century, as Commodore Perry opening up Japan in 1854. Those events and those trends began in 1 year, and they unfolded over 15 or 20 years or several decades in the case of Japan, and the result had an enormous impact on the world as a whole. That's what I think is going on in the Soviet Union. And that's really basically what I'm going to try to describe in this book, pulling together a lot of the material that you see in the television series, but going beyond it to talk more about how it plays out and the impact on the rest of the world, and to give you a fuller portrait of what I call the new Russians.
Well, Hedrick Smith, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
I enjoyed it, Terry.
Hedrick Smith is the host of the TV series Inside Gorbachev's USSR, which is broadcast Monday evenings on public television. He's now writing a book also called The New Russians. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.